This is the second part of essentially a discussion that's come out of Romans 9, 10, and 11 in our Bible study. For those of you who have just arrived yesterday, I'm Barry Shelley. I'm program associate here on the staff. And I think what I'd like to do is to just do a very, very brief review or summary of what happened yesterday and what discussion was all about, because I know some of you are, maybe I should ask, are there people here today that were not here yesterday? Okay, I thought there were. I was assuming that. Just to give you a very brief rundown on how we came to a point of saying we'd like to consider continuing this discussion instead of moving on as we had originally scheduled, and to raise the question, and then to basically today, I think, just really have a lot of discussion about it. And I would like to begin that discussion when I finish doing the summary by just asking a few people to give their reflections on the question of salvation, God's mercy to non-Christians, and the related questions to that, so that we have sort of a spectrum of ideas that are out on the table before then we begin discussing them in more detail, if that seems like a good way to go for people. For those of you who were not here yesterday, we began a study of Romans this week, and moved to the point yesterday of looking at chapters 9, 10, and 11, which really all sort of fit together and are Paul's struggling with the question of what about the Jews? Paul is a Jew himself. He's very distressed by the fact that now that Christ has come, so many of his Jewish brothers and sisters are not accepting Christ as the Messiah. And therefore, in the way he sees that, it seems only clear that then they are no longer part of God's elect. They're no longer essentially saved people. And that is a real struggle for him, because he sees the Jewish people as having been God's chosen people all along. They were the people of the covenants from Moses on through the history of the Old Testament. And so he is saying, well, does that mean that God has forsaken them? Does it mean that God has revoked God's promises to those people? And he goes about trying to answer that question. He does that with several different kinds of reflections. He essentially says, well, maybe first of all, to really be part of Israel, to be a Jew, does not necessarily mean just simply being part of the bloodline, to be a descendant bloodwise. He does that in chapter 9. He says that perhaps it's really more of a matter of being sharing in the faith of Abraham more than sharing in the blood lineage. So that's one thing he says. And then he talks a little bit more about his whole theology of grace that he has already covered in the first few chapters of Romans, and essentially saying that the problem is that the Jewish people are still trying to earn their place with God by following the law. And he says essentially we all know that that's impossible. There's no way that we can all uphold that law perfectly, that it's only those of us who accept the fact that we cannot earn God's grace that will actually experience God's grace, that when we give up trying to earn it, that's when we will understand it. He's essentially addressing a Roman church who are all Gentiles, and then essentially says the Jews have not heard the message. They have had plenty of time. The message has been there, the message of Christ, and they have not heard it. They have not accepted it. And that is really their fault. They don't have any excuses. But then finally, and this is where we we really sort of took off on our discussion that we will continue today, is that in chapter 11, he again asked the question, has God rejected God's people? And he really sort of lays out an explanation of the whole thing by saying that what we as Gentiles have to realize is that God is behind all of this in some way. That he even goes so far as to say that God has hardened the hearts of the Jews, so the Jews will not hear the message, so that then the message will be more easily spread to Gentiles. It's his way of saying God has a purpose in this. And then he cautions the Gentiles, saying, you must still see yourselves as part of Israel, part of this whole history of covenants with God. Don't be haughty about this. Don't be uppity about it. You can, if you fail to live your life faithfully, you could end up in the same place. And then finally, in the very end of the chapter, comes back to essentially saying that we have to realize that the Jews have, their disobedience is really what has led to our hearing the gospel, and we've got to be thankful for that, see their purpose in that. And then he says, and I think maybe we'll just reread perhaps I'll just read it. Let's look at, if you look at chapter 11, verses 28 through the end of the chapter 36. Let's just read this one more time and then we'll begin our discussion. As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake. In other words, what I just said, they are enemies of the gospel, but that's to your benefit because you've now heard the word that you probably wouldn't have heard if this had been kept as an isolated kind of belief within the Jewish community. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. For the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. Just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they have now been disobedient, in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may receive mercy. For God has consigned all persons to disobedience, that God may have mercy upon all. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are God's judgments, and how inscrutable God's ways! For who has known the mind of the Lord, and who has been the Lord's counselor? Or who has given a gift to God, that God might be repaid? For from God, and through God, and to God are all things. To God be glory forever. Amen. And we discussed yesterday about this idea that the call of God was irrevocable. It does seem to say that in some way the Jewish people will be saved in the end. And then finally in verses 33 through 36, we discussed how really in the end it seems like Paul is saying the wisdom of God is so far beyond our own that in the end we can't really understand all of this. That everything is from, through, and to God, and that it, at some point we have to... as the quotes there from 34 and 35 are from Isaiah and from Job, who has known the mind of the Lord? At some point we have to have faith and not necessarily think that we can know what God is thinking. So out of that, our discussion first was on the sort of salvation of Jews, and then we started talking a little bit about how do we approach non-Christians? Do we automatically assume that they are all condemned if they have not accepted Christ? The question came up, what about those people who never hear the Christian message? And then, so how do we approach that? And we had some differences of opinion, and out of that, really only at the very end of our discussion. So therefore, we left it up to the group and decided we would continue the discussion. Probably took a little bit more time to review than we needed, but maybe that helps us at least get going. So what I'd like to do now, and again, without immediate responses, is to get a few people, and I've talked to a couple people already that expressed some opinions yesterday, just simply on the question of how do we approach non-Christians? I think maybe is the best way to put it. Do we see non-Christians, or see our responsibility to non-Christians entirely as trying to baptize them as Christians and to convert them to Christians because otherwise they are not saved? Or on the other hand, is there a way in which we, out of our Christian love and response, need to simply be loving to people and responsive to them and assume that perhaps God's saving grace can act in ways other than just being formally a Christian? Does that seem like a fair way to put the question out of our discussion yesterday? Okay, would a few people just simply give a sort of summary of their reflections on that? And perhaps I've talked to a couple people who said they'd be willing just to sort of start that out, people who said something yesterday, and then anybody else. And then after we've had a chance for people just simply to give your viewpoint, then we'll open it up for discussion. But I'd like to do that first before we get into back and forth kinds of discussion. So would you mind starting, Phyllis, just because you...
I don't really know what I said all yesterday. I let the Spirit lead me. I guess my concern is, and the question I have that I'm confronted with is, when you remember the commission in Matthew where it says, go ye therefore and teach all nations and baptizing them. And doing a lot of religious study when I was in college of Shindu and Hindu, and you think of the communists and whatever, the Indians, how do I approach those people when I know somewhat of their religious background already, that they do have a God with a different name than our God, probably pointing to the same God in a different language, formation of language.
I think they've just finished for the summer. Explain. we have been dealing for several years now with a new sewer system that is both necessary, also required by law because of some new regulations, and we've run into several unexpected problems with that. Which again, this summer, after we thought we basically had most of it taken care of, required pretty massive project of hauling a lot of earth from down the road up the road because this particular soil up here did not pass the perk test. So most of the summer we have had trucks going up and down this road, which we almost never have, and they finished yesterday and early this morning. So now they are leaving for good, and I'm sure that's why they're doing it. But it is the price. We are talking now probably about $500,000 to $600,000 cost for the whole thing is what it's been. So anyway, it's nice to know that we will have the roads free again of water and dust and travel. So now.
Yeah.
My concern is, how do I minister unto them? Because I know how I have felt, and I did bring this in yesterday, when the Seventh-day Adventist or another group, maybe the door-to-door canvassing. Do you, because I believe that Jesus Christ is my only Savior, how do I approach people who I think, or maybe I don't even know, have Christ as their salvation? Because I know that by Christ's death and believing in Him, I have salvation. And I also want to believe that I think of the people in Africa and India who've never heard the word. What a commission we have, you know? What type of salvation do they have?
Okay.
That's a concern of mine. I'm not saying they don't have salvation, but I want to be sure that I'm doing my part, because God has put me here to tell the salvation to others.
Very well said. I think the Spirit was there. And would you,
I have a lot of problems with assuming that my way is the only way. And so when I meet people who are Hindus or Muslims, and when I think of all of the strength of the Muslim church in the world and the numbers we're talking about, I have a lot of trouble believing that God has consigned them to the outer dimensions. I just feel that there's a missing link somewhere, that my brain is not big enough and great enough to understand, just like Paul says, how inscrutable are God's ways. So I don't really feel I have the right to tell them that they have to repent or that they are wrong. I feel that we're worshiping the same God. And if they come to me and say, I want to learn about you and your way, then I will be happy to tell them. But I can't go out and say, hey, you're wrong. You need to become a Christian and repent. I think that their way and that their religion has a lot to come in.
Okay, thanks. Would somebody like to express an opinion that is one of saying that really the people who were most expressed the opinion of Christ really being the only way to salvation, and therefore our response has to be one of conversion, are not here. I thought they were coming, but I want to know if somebody would like to express that side of the issue. Yeah, okay.
I felt that, of course, the Muslim religion, as we're viewing it now, has the moderate and then the fanatical. Mm-hmm. And viewing it from the Ayatollah's viewpoint, their religion is based on fear and hate, where ours is based on trust and love, faith and fear and hate as opposed to trust and love. And, of course, in the early European history, when the Muslims went into Southern Europe, it was convert to their faith or be killed. And I can't believe that comes from God. And I believe that if we do confront or get into a discussion with a Muslim, that it's best to present that our faith is built on trust and love, and God's love sending His only Son to die for the whole world, not just for the Christians or a select few, but the whole world. But then we must accept His gift, His sacrifice.
So we really do need to become Christians before we can expect.
Well, yes, yeah. We should.
Okay.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be very good saints.
All right. Anybody else like to give an opinion that might be slightly different than anything that's been said? And we'll just pull it up.
There's one thing that I look at fits in now, but in Romans 2, starting with chapter verse 12, there it tells about if they have not heard, the Jews have the law, they sin are judged, for it is not by hearing the law that people are put right with God, but by doing what the law demands. Gentiles do not have the law, but whenever they do by instinct what the law commands, they are their own law, even though they do not have the law. Their conduct shows that what the law commands is written in their hearts. Their consciences also show that this is true, since their thoughts sometimes accuse them and sometimes defend them. And so, according to the good news I preach, this is how it will be on that day when God, through Jesus Christ, will judge the secret thoughts of all. So, but these are people who have not heard of Christ. And, but according to this, if they live a good life, that there is a chance for them. I don't know. But that's one thing, you have responsibility for, I think, that if we tell them about this and then they don't accept it, then we are kind of responsible for them not being saved. That's the way I look at it, anyhow.
Would it be fair to say then that it's almost, now I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I'm really trying to ask a question, I'm not trying to twist it either. Would it be fair to say then that if somebody doesn't hear the gospel, but they still live their lives like that, that then essentially God will save them, but if they hear it and don't respond, then they're not probably going to receive God's grace.
Does it kind of sound that way?
That's what I'm asking. That's sort of what I heard it is that you're saying.
I feel that way too, but I feel like we still have this commandment to go out and tell.
Okay, all right.
That should not excuse us for not going out and telling.
Okay, all right.
I have kind of similar comment, but maybe a little different. Okay. I do believe, you know, that Jesus said no one comes to the Father except through me. I also believe that God is a fair God, okay, and a righteous God, but it's up to him to judge and not me, you know. And so if I'm going around saying, well, these Hindus probably have salvation and whatever, then I'm putting myself in God's place and judging. And so my job is to obey, and the Bible does say, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel, and it does share the gospel. And so my job is to share that with others. Then it's up to the Lord to do the judging, but it's not my job to decide that people can become Christians can be saved without becoming a Christian, because that's doing the same thing that Adam and Eve did, putting themselves in the place of God. You know, I mean, it's like that's the sin that that's been the problem all through, is people putting themselves in the place of God to make that judgment. Okay. So I need to obey rather than judge, make that decision.
All right.
I hear a question coming out of all this.
What do you need to do?
Even when you're this morning, just to share with one another, how can we all be comfortable in sharing the message? That's my life. I just love telling the good news. I'm sure I upset a few people because they tell the good news. Maybe that's the question we should be asking. How do we tell the good news, then let God do the work?
And just as you said, you're telling the good news. You're not going around saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, but you're sharing the good news.
I find out quite often I'm wrong, you know, by people disagree with me. You hear about that. But to have that confidence to stand up and say, yes, I believe in Jesus Christ, and this is what it's done for me. Try it. Try it.
Somebody, you just hold on just a second. Ann, go. Oh, Ann had her hand up. I guess she's gone. Let me just say that she probably has had to go to work. That's probably what it is. That's too bad. I think there are, we start with one question, and anytime we start talking about this, there are always others. And I think a question is how we share the Christian message, but maybe even prior to that is, what is the Christian message? Is it necessarily just simply accept Christ? I mean, I'm not in any way insinuating that that's not part of the message. And also, what is salvation? And I think that all has to be part of this. I'll just simply throw those out. And then why don't we just completely open it up for, I mean, I think we've already started that anyway. Just open it up for any discussion, any comments, either about those questions, and we'll just see where it goes. And yes, back here.
I think basically, for sure, we're all children of God, no matter what our religion is. That's really, really important, because we have such good examples. Every one of us are a child of somebody. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, I don't have 50%, but you know, I would be willing to say 99 to 100% would not want to reject the child. They might get angry when they disobey, but it seems like they would never disown their own child. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a basic premise, that God does love everyone.
Okay.
Need us all. There's an answer to what she said about it upsetting some people when you spill. So perhaps that's the planting of the seed. It may upset them, but it may make them think. Maybe the ones that just sit and nod their heads go away and don't think about it again. It's along the parable of the seeds that fall in different places. I don't mean that you should want to do it to ourselves.
Well, sometimes we need to be upset.
Did anybody injure when that's a ruler? I try to keep my child away from the head. I'll just get it afterwards, okay?
Other comments?
First of all, we all have to make the decision on our own. I mean, we hear the call from Christ. We have to make that decision whether we're going to be with Christ or we're going to go the other way. We go either to hell or heaven or hell. No glory from Christ.
Okay. There's no other way except by accepting Christ, is what you're saying.
We each have to make that decision on our own.
Okay.
Nobody can make that decision for us.
How about babies?
Pardon?
How about babies?
We can dedicate them, or baptize them, but later in life they have to make their own decision. They can't go out and live.
No, but.
Drunken lives, wild lives.
When you say we all have to make that decision to be saved, but
then go to heaven without making.
We have to depend on God's grace. I mean, it's what God does, not what we do.
Okay. This was part of our earlier discussion this week, was how much of it's God and how much of it's us, and whether or not if it's still all God. Whether I think what you're saying is it may still be, it's still eventually God's grace, but we have to respond to
that.
Yeah, and we have to make that decision to accept it or not. Yeah.
He's got his arms open.
Right.
But
so,
if we don't make that decision, there's no hope for us.
So that would include someone who, say, was a very devout Buddhist. If they did not accept Christ, then you're...
As far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Okay. All right.
As far as worshiping other gods, in India they worship cows.
Well, I don't know how much we want to get. I would disagree that the Hindus worship cows. Cows are sacred. That doesn't mean that they worship cows as God. I mean, I think it's... but the point you're making, I think, is certainly clear in that it's... For you, it has to be Christian. I think Kit was going to say something, and I'll come back to you.
One of the classic breaks in Hindu theology was a fight centuries and centuries ago. They divided up sort of battle lines over what they called the cat school and the monkey school of God's grace. And I found those images very helpful when I think about my own Christianity. Those who belong to the monkey school said that God is like a mother monkey who picks up her young, but then the baby monkey has to throw its arms around the mother's neck to hang on. then there was the cat school. Those people understood God's grace as if God were a mother cat who picks the kitten up by the scruff of the neck, and whether the kitten holds on or not, the mother carries that cat. Well, I guess in terms of Christianity, I'm more and more coming down in terms of the cat school. I think God's grace picks us up and holds on to us whether we struggle or whether we hold back or not. Sometimes we can learn useful things from our brothers and sisters. But are we ever able to walk?
Well, the cat is, if you're going to see that in.
Well, I mean, analogies all fall apart sometimes. You know, when I look at my Christian life, obviously I'm walking better now than I was 10 years ago, and, you know, certainly better than I was 20 years ago, but I don't think there's ever a time in my life that I will be able to walk the Christian life on my own without God's carrying me.
Because God, your walk and faith of life to me is up like a roller coaster. Someone explained it to me one time. You've got your high spiritual peak. Then if you have a crisis in your life, it can bring you down. And you can really question God. It's happened in my life. I believe a very strong faith, but when we became unemployed year after year, I started asking the question, God, why us? And then when I had the friend who said, of all the people, why should you have to go through this continually? You're faithful to God, you work in the church continually, you're caring, you're the most loving person you could find. But God still had me do that. And every time we were unemployed, we went down. But the time that year was up, something happened that spiritually, it was a peak, it went up. And I guess the most I've learned from it is how I can support those people who are employed. Because I'd be sitting in a Bible study, and I know the people weren't thinking, and they say, well, all people who don't work, have a job, are lazy. And we were not lazy. But see how I learned it? I became so sensitive to the poor, the unemployed, that someday maybe I will think I should write. But that you are faithful, and with God is righteous in all circumstances. We've learned that. We've learned that we don't need all these material things, and live one day at a time, and you'll be just as happy and joyful. But you could have never told me that the first 4 years ago, the first time you were unemployed. And my husband is the one who is the unemployed. And I'm amazed at how he's holding up. And it's only because God's been in our life. And that's our growth piece. Sometimes I think I'm really up here, then all of a sudden I think, oh my gosh, I'm way down here, you know? But that's so neat. And like you said over there, we don't walk alone. I know I can't walk alone. And that's what I'd love to have everyone in the world to have, that inner peace. Because that's what salvation is all about. Here on earth. Here on earth, I have eternity. Not wait until I die, but now. And that's what I want to share with people. And I'd love to see everyone who says, I believe in Jesus Christ, to share that. Our Christian church would be so filled, we'd have to enlarge every church I know we would, instead of have empty pews. If we, as Christians, could accept that commitment to tell on the mountain, but we're afraid to. We are so afraid.
I think the question of salvation is really good one. You had your hand up.
What was I
going to
say?
Well, I think...
I'm not sure.
I had a Sunday school boy who went on to Concordia College. And he came home and he said, I've sure learned something. All these people, we grew up as Christians, we were baptized as children, all we've known from what we got. He said, I've met people that have never heard of me. He said, how hard it would be. This has been so part of our life that we just, he just couldn't figure out how. And I think that's probably the trouble with a lot of people. We inherit this from our grandparents. It's part of our life, always has been part of our life. And
take it for granted.
I think that's kind of critical of people that don't take it. Especially in Minnesota, we come from their Lutherans, that's all there is.
I guess I'd like to just throw out some of my own opinions, if I can be allowed to do that. And even if you don't, I probably will anyway. But just maybe to give some other things to chew on here. I think for me, it's really important to see evangelism not just... Evangelism for me is sharing the good news, but that does not necessarily mean that the absolutely only purpose of that is to try to convert somebody to Christianity. For me, mission work is a matter of sharing God's love, and that is, I think, first and foremost, a matter of responding to the needs of people around the world. And I think it's through that we share God's love. I think that that if through our mission work, which may be everything from agricultural programs to teaching to all sorts of other kinds of work, that people respond by wanting to know why we're doing this, then I think that's when real conversion takes place. There, I can't even remember the name now. There used to be an order of monks in France who were not allowed to say that they were Christians. They didn't wear habits. They didn't wear robes. What do you call them?
Robes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they wore nothing. That identified nothing that identified them as a religious order, and they were not allowed to say that they were Christians. The idea was that they had to live their lives with so much love that people would want to know what their motivation was. Now, I'm not suggesting that we don't do that. I do believe in preaching the word in a direct way as well. So I'm just going to sort of throw out a few points that are related without filling in all the gaps because of time.
A modern group or?
No, this was centuries ago. I read about this somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I think it is something that points out for us that it really should be through our sharing of the gospel in what we do and what our mission is, instead of primarily focusing on preaching in the sense of just simply talking. And I think that comes with it. I do believe that to say that Christ is the only revelation of God that is saving is really limiting who God is. I believe that for me, Christ is the ultimate revelation of God. And I think that's who Jesus is. Jesus is the person who in this world comes to bring God closer to me. Because God is so far beyond who I am that Christ is a human being who comes in the flesh to help me in my relationship and my understanding to God. I don't believe that God is so small or would be so lazy as to only have that one crowning revelation 2,000 years ago. I really do believe that God reveals God's self every day to us through different people. Now, I don't think that everybody is Christ. I don't mean to say that either. But I really do believe that the overall message of the Bible tells me that, as somebody responding says, that God is a merciful and loving God. And it just does not seem right to me to believe in a God that would allow primarily cultural influences to either save or not save us. I am a Christian primarily, first and foremost, as you said, you grew up in Minnesota and you're a Lutheran. I'm a Christian because I grew up in a Christian culture. Now, I did, as you said, make a decision, which is a very real decision for me at some point in my life, to accept Christ as my Savior, in terms of which I said those words. So it is not just a cultural thing. But the fact is that the chances are that I would not be Christian if I grew up in Nepal. The chances are that I would be Buddhist. It's very hard for me to believe that God would make it that much easier for me to be a Christian and therefore be saved than for somebody who happened just by circumstance to be born in another culture. It is just very difficult for me to believe that. So essentially, I think what I come to is a point of where Paul came in the end of Romans 11, essentially saying, I don't know, but everything points me in the direction of saying that other people experience God's saving grace. And a lot of that's my own personal experience of having met and having incredible contact with people who are Buddhist and Native Americans primarily. And it is very clear to me that those people experience a kind of depth of spirituality and relationship with the divine that most Christians that I have met don't. It's very hard for me to say then that God is going to condemn them to hell. The other thing I would say is, in relation to that, is that I think that if we only approach somebody as somebody to be converted, that we're not seeing them fully as who they are. And I think everything Jesus tells me is just the opposite of that. That Jesus wants us to approach everyone as neighbor and love them. And certainly part of loving them is to share our own gospel, but I don't think that sharing that necessarily means the expectation that that person then has to become formally a Christian in the way that we think of that. And I would say just a couple other things, and then I'll let you. I think we also really lose out on learning from other faiths. I think that Christianity is the truth, but I don't think that means it's exclusively the truth. And I also think that our culture certainly biases the way we see things. And I think we can learn a lot from people in the East about what it means to know God. And if we really learn from them and dialogue from them, that we can learn from that. The absolute final thing is to say salvation. I think we too often only think of salvation as after we die on this earth, and salvation is whether or not we go to heaven or hell. And I really believe that we really miss a major part of the gospel when we don't see salvation as something that is already here and now in some way. We never experience that perfectly, but I think we get glimpses of it when we have a sense of wholeness and peace in our lives that you're talking about. For me, it really means that I think that to know God, and I really do believe that that Allah and Jehovah and Buddha, well, that gets a little more difficult, but we won't get into that. But I think they do. They don't actually have a name for a God in the same way we do, but I do believe that there is a sense of the divine there in the same way I do. In fact, Buddhism is one of the religions that I feel most closely drawn to outside of Christianity.